Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Underwater cameraman and documentary maker Ken O'Sullivan has been in the water again, specifically the Atlantic Ocean. For the last few years, he's been searching for some of the biggest creatures who swim off our shores. Fin whales, basking sharks, killer whales, and the smaller creatures who follow in their wake. And Ken has a new three-part series on RTÉ1 TV on Sundays at 6:30, and it's called North Atlantic. Ken, you're very welcome. Thank you very much. Being here.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing I noticed, the introductory moment from the first of episode, is you're still in awe of the sea, aren't you?
Oh, for God's sake, yeah. I mean, I'm blessed to live by the sea in La Hinch. I swim every day and, you know, I'm grateful. In fact, every day I get out of the water, I face the sea and I'm just grateful for the experience. Yeah, it's incredible. And some of these animals that we have in Ireland, in Irish waters, you know, fin whales, 40 species of sharks, and we documented some ones probably for the first time in this series. I mean, it's the best job ever. It's better than having a real job.
Yeah, but you get a real sense of the power of the sea and the respect that you have for it too.
Ah, look, as I said, you know, we've all lost people, and every day I get out, whether I've been on a ship or swimming or anything or on a rib, I mean, I give thanks for safe passage, because you never know the day you lose respect for the sea. And it's funny, we've been all over the world. You'll hear something, an old saying in every language that says that the day you lose respect for the sea is a fateful day for you.
Yeah.
So it's a great privilege.
Now, these three episodes, what did you start out to do? What was the aim?
Well, so we wanted to, I suppose, a bit of an open book, Claire, in terms of I wanted to go out into the North Atlantic to search for some of the largest creatures that we have there, in particular fin whales, killer whales, various species of sharks, and to try and understand these animals, to try and understand where they go to feed, where they go to breed. And in the case of fin whales, these are the second largest animals ever to have lived. The largest weigh 80 tons, which is 2 articulated lorries or 16 elephants, and I've been as close to the one in the water as I am to you now, which was absolutely terrifying. But incredibly, we know nothing really about where they go to breed, which is a large part of the year that they come into our waters to feed for certain times of the year. And so to try and understand, you know, I don't like ecosystem, it's not a great word, but I suppose it describes to try and understand how the ocean ecosystem works with these animals.
And you talk as well, I mean, you said how close you got to the fin whale, but you talk about respect and keeping your distance as well. How important is that?
Look, you know, it's hard enough to film these animals, but to do it in a way that doesn't interfere with them, which is my primary aim, makes it, you know, much more difficult. Look, I'm trying to document these animals and tell their stories. I'm not doing it for my own gratification. You know, I was incredibly fortunate to swim with blue whales in our last series. You know, I probably wouldn't do it again, because I've told their story. And of course, we do interfere with them with boats and swimmers. And, you know, we had incredible basking shark presence in Irish waters the last couple of weeks. And there's loads of stuff on social media, which is great. And I don't think anybody would deliberately interfere with these animals. But it's certainly so important not to interfere with them, because they're getting a brief window to feed in these waters in springtime, and the animals, their numbers were decimated by hunting. So
tell us then about the practicalities of it. Like, how many of you are out there shooting? You're obviously the underwater guy, but what goes into it all to come up with the footage that you need?
Well, the biggest thing is the waiting time. So as we know, you know, these are temperate waters, so it's the stormiest seas on the planet, really, the North Atlantic and the, you know, the equivalent in the South Atlantic. We're forever waiting. You're trying to match up conditions with the availability of the animals. There's usually 3 or 4 of us on our rib. We do most of our filming on our rib, rigid inflatable boat, and a driver, and then an underwater cameraman, a drone, and an overwater guy, and a sound recordist some days too. Just desperately trying to find these animals. And, you know, I've been doing this for 18 years now. I've done 17 or 18 documentaries. This was by a million miles the hardest. We found it really difficult to find feeding fin whales.
Why was that?
Again, we probably don't know enough to give a definitive statement on it, but certainly, you know, the huge overfishing for sprat in Irish waters, which would have been one of their main dietary prey, has to have an issue with that. I spent 2.5 summers, 29 days at sea, and I encountered fin whales feeding twice, and only one of those occasions we were able to get close enough to film them. Yeah, it's quite difficult.
And you would have expected to see them far more often, is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely, we would have done. I mean, I filmed them for 12 or 13 years before this documentary. That doesn't mean that they weren't feeding many, many more days than that, but in terms of us being on call more or less all the time, having great contacts with fishermen, with whale watchers, with our friends on the coast. You know, we even put up a plane one day to do sightings. We've got guys on the shore with binoculars. So yeah, it's very difficult.
It's a huge undertaking, you know.
Ah, it isn't. It isn't.
You know, as you say, the waiting, yeah. The waiting game is the toughest part of it, isn't it?
It is, Claire. Look, as I keep saying, it's better than a real job. And I'd hate to misrepresent it, but we had great days. Oh my God, we had great days off the coast of West Cork and Kerry and Clare.
And Norway.
We went to, so we follow the herring. So if you're going to try and understand the ecosystem, how the ocean works, then for these large animals, you need to follow what they eat, which is fish. And herring are hugely historically important fish in Ireland. You know, my own family fished for them from Corrocks for hundreds of years. And they were a winter fishery, so it was protein at a time when food was scarce for coastal communities. Sadly, there are two fisheries in Ireland which are now both closed because of the numbers are small and the fish they were catching were small. Some small scientific fisheries going on. So we went to Norway because we figured we'd find big shoals of herring there and to see what predators showed up. And you'll have to tune in to see what actually happened.
Ah, tell us. Tell us what happened. Because you had a big moment, didn't you, when you were filming in Norway?
We had a couple of big moments. No,
you might want to keep it secret, do you?
We had one with the weather and then we had one. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of equidistant from a 15-metre humpback whale and a pod of orcas, a pod of killer whales, you know, as far as I am from you now, 2 metres. And
what's that like when that happens?
It's insane. It's absolutely terrifying. But, you know, you're as the cameraman, it's years to get into that position and your predominant thought is not to mess it up, just to get it. And you go back in the evening and we play it back and then we manage to get a couple of iconic shots. It's, you know, absolutely worth it.
And when it comes to not messing it up, what are the rules around that?
Look, you just have to get the shot. That's it. The whale goes past. And I shoot drama for an American documentary in a pool in Cork a couple of years ago about sinking of a ship and sailors. And it was fantastic. The World War II recreation scenes, costumes and lights. And the director was saying, God, Ken, what you do is difficult. And I said, are you joking? I said, I just said to that sailor there, you know, could you just turn around to face the light a bit more? I said, you know, with a fin whale, I got one chance in 3 years to film it. And if I'm not in focus, they're not exposed. So, look, I don't want to, again, give the impression it's terrible. It's the most privileged job on the planet.
Absolutely not, but I'm just fascinated to know. So all of your equipment is working. Let's take that as a given, right? Because you're a professional.
Which it doesn't, of course.
But anyway, in terms of your physical presence, do you have to remain incredibly still or do you have to move in tandem with the creature you're filming? Or how does that work?
Well, typically what we do with, say, large whales like baleen whales, fin whales, blue whales, humpbacks, is that you try to observe where they're moving because, you know, a lot of the time they'll take straight lines or you try to get near the feed, the fish that they're feeding on, and if we follow birds, etc. And then if you think they're coming to you, you stay still. And a lot of the times I free dive because scuba it's just too cumbersome to get in. I might get in and out of the water 50 times in a day. And also bubbles we know are a sign of aggression between whales. So if two males kind of are sending out signals, they'll start blowing bubbles. So not a great idea for me to get into the water. I'm 6'4", but I mean, I'm minuscule beside these animals. And try to be in the right position, which is the hardest thing to do, really. Sometimes in our waters, we might be able to see for 2 or 3 metres. And, you know, there's no record that I can find of a killer whale or indeed any other whale attacking anybody in the water, other than in SeaWorld in California. But that's a different story. So these whales, they have no interest in us.
But they wouldn't need to attack you to do you harm.
Absolutely. But I spent a lot of years learning to do this. I was lucky to work with some of the best guys in the world. And a neighbour of mine, a farmer, said, you're crazy doing that. I said, look at, you see that those bullocks and the horse in the field? I wouldn't go in there because I don't know how those animals behave. I do understand to a degree how whales behave.
Yeah, so. But for the rest of us, I mean, free diving, free diving and filming these 80-ton creatures is an extraordinary thing to do. It really is.
Thank you very much.
What did you learn then about whale behaviour that was new to you over this experience of filming this series?
We documented a few new things, and again, I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, just in terms of how whales feed, in particular minke whales, which are about 8 or 9 metres long and probably our most common whales that we see inshore in Ireland, in our inshore waters. I spent 9 years trying to film a particular species of shark, poor beagle sharks, and these are remarkably similar in appearance to great whites, except they're only about 2.5-3 metres long, so smaller. And after 9 years, I managed to encounter a female in the water, and it was just incredible. I mean, most beautiful animal you could ever imagine, just beautiful and sleek. And again, Claire, I can find no credible record in Ireland of anyone being attacked by a shark in our waters. And I don't want to put people off, but we know where I live in Clare and the West Coast, you know, they were coming into these bays in the summer to feed. And, you know, we were bathing there. People have done for hundreds of years and nobody knew they were even there. So they have no interest in us.
The seabirds play a role as well, don't they? And they were sort of a useful, they were like signal men going out for you because they were showing you where things might be.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is probably the main thing that we use to try and locate the feeding with whales and dolphins and other creatures, is we can see the seabirds because we can see them from far away. And yeah, so we try to track them because the birds, we think, and it's something we kind of propose in the documentary, that seabirds are probably using a sense of smell because phytoplankton give off a gas, dimethyl sulfide, DMS. And it's my theory, but we did find one paper on it, and perhaps we can do a little bit more work with some researchers on that. You can smell it. So when we get to the Blasket Islands and parts of Cork, if we get to the Mid-Atlantic, the shellfish, you can smell it in the water. You can smell the gas of plankton. So seabirds are amazing. We managed to have a wonderful scene at the Cliffs of Moher with guillemots and puffins and razorbills diving and coming in front of the camera. And, you know, they're auks, or they're same family as penguins, a little bit awkward on land, but oh my God, wait till you see them underwater. They're just the most graceful, beautiful swimmers.
Again, and that's the privilege, you know, you get to see all of that, and we will too, as a result of your work. The dark ocean. Now, that can be frightening, the concept of the darkness and the cold and the depth, but you say that's an essential part of the jigsaw when it comes to fertility and breeding.
Absolutely. I mean, in a very simplistic sense, the winter storms that we get in at our latitudes in the shallow waters, they churn up all the nutrients, all of the dead matter that's on the seabed. They churn that up and bring it up into the water. And then in spring, when we get long days of sunlight, because at our latitudes we get amazing amount of sunlight, that causes photosynthesis, which creates plankton blooms, which starts the entire food chain. I suppose we're using it, you know, I'd come across many years ago, there were Arab explorers long, long time ago, 1,000 years ago, that came up to these latitudes, and they described it, where we are, as the dark ocean. And I was doing some research then in the Maritime Museum in Lisbon, because the Portuguese were incredible seafarers. And oddly enough, when they came up around Ireland, they called it the dark ocean. But I suppose the notion of the dark ocean, we're kind of putting it forward as a metaphor for what we didn't know, or I suppose our ignorance, the damage we've done to the ocean. And then the last episode is called Into the Light. And we're trying to kind of say, well, OK, you know, it's enlightenment. Here's what we now know and what we can do to try and help this thing. So it's metaphorical, I suppose.
Because you've mentioned overfishing, but you also deal with pollution and with plastics as well. So you're acknowledging where we are, but what you're proposing is that there is hope. And the documentary series is part of showing people what perhaps can be saved and what needs to be protected.
Ah, look, there's always hope. There has to be, you know. And the amazing thing about nature is that if you leave it alone, it recovers. Now, you know, maybe it takes 10 years or 100 years, but if you stop causing the damage and remove the source, I guess they're almost disturbing scenes of what we've done to some of these animals through toxicity and stuff that has leaked into the ocean, and chemicals and DDT and PCPs and that kind of thing. But I always feel I have to leave people with some sense of hope in that. But coming back to the notion of enlightenment, I mean, I'm making documentaries for 18 years, and every one of my documentaries has conservation issues. And it's wonderful that others have now discovered that, and particularly the really big series, you know, because they didn't until a couple of years ago. That's wonderful, wonderful that they've now done that. But you've got to tell these stories, and we don't pull punches in terms of showing what's there. And education is a huge facet. We donated our last series, Ireland's Deep Atlantic, to the educational curriculum, and it's now on the geography and business studies. Now, that took 5 years, and it was Colm O'Callaghan and RTE and Ciarán Cassin and BEI working with the department. you know, but then it happens. So every teenager now sees humpback whales off Clare and Kerry.
Wonderful.
And as opposed to reading a textbook about the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, makes such a difference when you can see it, which is why you're doing
and
what,
identify
what you do.
With it.
And the music for the series, I know you're very proud of this. It was specially commissioned, written by Bradley Ayres, performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra. And that provides a whole other layer of beautiful complexity to the story, doesn't it?
Oh, look, you know, I mean, Bradley, I worked with his dad at the BBC. He's 23. I mean, a genius, an absolute genius. And it was it's his first big commission. We took a chance on him and I said, why not? And I'm very proud of it, but I didn't compose it. But, you know, as the music was coming through, I mean, sometimes we'd send him pictures and he'd send a piece. I mean, I was crying, and Mary Crumlish, our editor, even owned up to it once or twice. It's really beautiful, and thankfully, Joe Chibi and the RT Concert Orchestra agreed to perform it. And I mean, that was just to stand in the middle of a 52-piece orchestra. I was crying. The girls were asking me, "Are you okay?" I said, "I'm happy crying." But it's really beautiful, and I hope people will enjoy it.
Well, we're going to hear some of that music in a moment, but just to remind people, North Atlantic will air on RT1 and the RT Player from Sunday, the 14th of May. That's at 6:30, and it's a three-parter.
3 1-hours. Yes.
Ken, thank you very much for joining us. It's been lovely to have you with us. And we're going to finish with a piece that we were just talking about, specially commissioned to accompany the series. This is Minke Whale Hunt.
Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.